Several women's groups are considering boycotting the federal government's inquiry into family law. On the grounds, the deputy chair, One Nation leader, Pauline Hanson, would bias the probe. Speaking on Breakfast yesterday, Senator Hanson said some women are lying about family violence and custody disputes.
There are people out there who are nothing but liars and will use that in the court system. You can't defend these people and I will not defend them.
That's Senator Pauline Hanson speaking on Breakfast. Dr. Jane Wangman from the University of Technology Sydney is a researcher on family violence. She was a member of the New South Wales Domestic Violence Review Team and has worked as a solicitor for a community legal centre as well. Welcome to Breakfast.
Thank you, Hamish.
You've worked as a solicitor in a community legal centre. Did you come across many cases where claims of domestic violence were questionable?
I did not in my practice, but one of the things that I researched and it came out of my practice work was the problem of cross-application. So this is when both parties seek a protection order against each other. And this is a growing concern across the jurisdictions where we're seeing mutual allegations. And I did look at the differences between men's and women's allegations. Women's allegations are much more likely to document fear and to be long-standing experiences of family violence. And this is quite different to what men were claiming.
So I suppose the difficulty with the assertions being made by Pauline Hanson yesterday was that there didn't appear to be any actual evidence to support the claims that she was making. I mean, can we sort of go back to the beginning of this and ask, are there women lying about family violence in the family courts to gain more access to their children? Does that happen?
Okay, so there's a number of things going on with what Pauline Hanson is claiming. This is a very powerful narrative that has come from men's rights groups. It was very powerful in generating the 2006 reforms that John Howard introduced. There is no evidence to support her allegations. Now, there are some early studies, like in the early 2000s from Canada and Australia, and they're about allegations around child abuse in particular, not in terms of intimate partner violence. But they have found that allegations that are false are very, very small. So ranging between 4 and 12%, depending on the nature of the study and what they were looking at. When you get in the family court, there's a big difference between saying that something is false and untrue compared to something that's unsubstantiated or they're unable to make findings about. There is absolutely no evidence to support that this is a widespread concern in which we might need to have an inquiry.
So is there any actual data, though, on what proportion of cases might involve false accusations of violence on any side of the gender divide?
Okay. So the Canadian study, which was published in 2005, found that amongst the general reporting of child abuse, around 4% were found to be false. When they went to the family court, they found it was around 12%. However, most of those allegations were physical abuse of children, and most of those allegations, the false allegations, were made by non-residential fathers. Similar findings were made in some Australian studies by Thea Brown and her colleagues. Again, women were more likely to make allegations, but their allegations were more likely to be substantiated than fathers. So when we talk about allegations around family violence and child abuse, we need to think about both allegations about the violence taking place, but also the response or denial about that violence. We have to ask about the veracity of those claims as well.
Your research, as I understand it, has looked at the use and the application of protection orders. Can you just explain for us this morning the legal or court processes used to check these kinds of claims and determine whether there is indeed a risk of violence?
Okay, so the protection orders are state laws, and so they vary a little bit across the jurisdictions and they have slightly different names. They were introduced because the criminal law was quite difficult for women, so this is around the early 80s, in order to prove claims, because a criminal offence has to be proven beyond reasonable doubt, and it was very hard to get those kinds of convictions. So protection orders were introduced to better respond to the problem of domestic and family violence. The standard of proof is lower, so it's a civil standard of proof, which is a balance of probabilities. This is appropriate for claims around domestic and family violence because there is usually the ability to have evidence is usually much lower. It happens behind, most of it happens behind closed doors, and it is one word against the other. But courts are well equipped and do this every day around a whole range of different matters about assessing the credibility of witnesses and also looking at other supporting evidence if there is any, like medical around injuries and stuff.
Pauline Hanson also questioned the grounds for some protection orders. Let's just take a listen.
This is happening all the time, and clients are using it, or those people are using these threats or these domestic violence orders in to support their case why that parent shouldn't see the children. I think this is so wrong.
So is that the case within the family court system, that it's used as a tool or a tactic?
Okay, so when you what I was talking about before was getting a protection order in a state jurisdiction. So when you come to the family court, whether it's the Federal Circuit Court or the Family Court of Australia, you will notify the court, usually through a form that tells the court about what family violence or child abuse might have taken place in the family, and it's a little bit different depending on which court you're in. People then support that information in their affidavit explaining what happened. And the types of evidence that they might use to support their claim is a personal protection order. So recent research by the Australian Institute of Family Studies found that around 30% of people had a protection order as something to support evidence, but they have a range of other things. And so this is particularly if you get to the pointy end where it is reaching judicial determination. People have subpoenaed material. They'll have police evidence. They might have evidence from various child protection agencies, psychological or counselling records, and records from school. All of these things go to support the allegations around family violence. Importantly, there's also, particularly if it goes to trial, there'll be a family report or a single expert evidence where those witnesses are also telling us about the nature of family violence and its relevance to children. This AAFE study that looked at the 2012 reforms, so there were a number of reforms that happened in 2012 to assist in enabling the court to get more information about family violence. Now, they found that in terms of those matters that were judicially determined, there was a change after 2012 around orders around equal shared parental responsibility, so they were less likely to be made. But time orders, so the time spent with a non-residential parent, did not change much at all following those reforms.
Why do you think these sorts of claims, because they have come up before, stir such or sort of capture the public attention so much?
Again, I think there's a number of things that are going on here. I think there is a lack of understanding in the general community, and lawyers and parliamentarians and so on form part of the general community, about the general prevalence of family violence. Now, the Personal Safety Service survey tells us that 1 in 4 women have experienced family violence in their lifetime. So it is very high, but it seems that there is a disconnect between understanding that prevalence and realising that family law cases are likely to involve the vast majority of those matters. I mean, that's a reason why people separate. I also think that this narrative of around false allegations builds into a very long-standing idea that women and children lie about these things. And that still seems to have a lot of traction around these things. We don't seem to make those allegations around other people making claims around violence.
And in terms of this particular inquiry, I suppose the question is this something that warrants further examination at the level that it will now receive it? I mean, do you think there is actually a job here for this inquiry to do on that particular facet? As Pauline Hanson said, this will be a holistic look at the system, but it was very clear what she viewed as being a key focus.
Okay, I don't think it will be a holistic inquiry. I think there is a problem with setting it up as looking at false claims. I think it does set it up as saying this is going to be our premise, this is our starting point. One of the reasons that the 2012 reforms came in was that the 2006 ones were seen as silencing people's claims, women's claims. And in 12, there had been a number of reports that came before that saying, actually, we need to know more. We need to hear more from victims of family violence about what's taking place. The setting up of this inquiry and the reports from women's groups and victims so far suggest that they will not engage with it because it is set up with this premise that it is about false allegations.
All right.
And I think that would be problematic.
Dr. Jane Wangman, I would love to continue our conversation. There's a bit of lag in the internet connection that we have with you, so I think we'll have to leave it there this morning. We appreciate your time, and undoubtedly we'll return to these matters over the coming weeks. Dr. Jane Wangman is a senior lecturer in the law faculty at UTS.